This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates, plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
It is Pollock and Thurston, and here we are live on Wednesday, March the 26th, the anniversary of the final broadcast of Monday Nitro.
Oh, my God. Back in 24 years ago.
24 years ago, yes, in 2001, where WCW went out with a flicker and the wrestling world completely changed.
After Ric Flair wrestling in a shirt. Yeah.
Wrestling in a shirt. 288 episodes, which AEW Dynamite will surpass in just a couple of weeks.
Speaking of episode counts, I was noticing, you know how many episodes we've done here for Pollock and Thurston?
I have no clue.
We recently...
I'll guess somewhere around 100.
Yeah. I was looking at the playlist that all these go into, and it was on mine, it was like 100, but I've got some that I think we did only on post. In any case, we've done over 100 episodes of this.
Look at that. That means we can now start to talk about syndication.
Syndication opportunities.
Once you hit 100 episodes. Yes. Okay.
Will we go into the NAPI? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, we should. I don't know if I could travel to the U.S. right now. I might not be able to come back. So you might have to be representing us for all of our U.S. Syndication packaging.
All right.
But today on the show, we're going to be joined by another American. Sean Ross Sapp is going to be returning to the show, as we are going to be chatting with him about the story coming out of TNA land on Tuesday about a number of cuts in various leadership and executive positions, as Gail Kim leading the list of names that are no longer at Anthem Sports / TNA. We will talk with Sean about that, as well about WrestleMania 41, which is rapidly approaching in Las Vegas, the buildup for WrestleMania. Maybe we'll talk to him a little bit about WrestleMania After Dark, as Brandon's itinerary just piling up with more events that you are going to have to take in. I know that your weekend is going to revolve around Tony Hinchcliffe and Machine Gun Kelly.
Yes, I'm still delaying my decision about whether to go, so we'll see.
Oh, okay. Well, keep us updated. As always, you have an open invite that weekend. You could review WrestleMania with us. Let us get into things before we tackle the news stories. Brandon, you possess the Signal app, correct?
I do. You can reach out to me on Signal. My username is Brandon. I think it's all one word. BrandonThurston.14. You can message me. I think you can even make phone calls. I've never made a phone call on Signal, but you can text me. End to end encryption. However, don't you dare send me anything that is sensitive national defense information. That would be a big problem. Don't do that.
Now, what would you do ethically if you were brought into a private chat with Mark Shapiro, Ari Emanuel, Nick Khan, and Paul Levesque, and they started talking about sensitive booking information and their plot to take over the entire boxing industry as well? How long would you stay in this
chat?
I'm
sure Paul Levesque has a lot of thoughts about that. I would, just as Jeffrey Goldberg did, suspect that I was being worked and wait for some sort of real world verification that this was a real actual group chat that I was added to.
Now, what if then Nick Khan publicly came out and said, this is a hoax, this is all being made up?
Is Turkey all shaken there?
Of course. Yes. Okay. Maybe that'd be the more interesting Signal group. Turkey, Dana White, Vince McMahon, and whoever else. And I'm certainly not the first one to bring this up, but the closest, I think, example, maybe we could even ask Sean if he's ever found himself in this situation. would have been like the errant Vince Russo email of 2014 to that he was attempting to send to Mike Tenay and instead ended up sending it to reporter Mike Johnson. And this news was so stunning at the time that Brandon was just left completely iced in response to this, because it was such surprising news at the time, where if you recall, in 2014, Vince Russo was under lock and key, keeping this secret that he was working on the TNA writing staff. And then this secret got out because of the fact that he had emailed Mike Johnson by mistake when he was trying to send show notes to Mike Tenay. And this was quite the blunder back in 2014.
I just rejoined the group here. And yeah. I know you're talking about Vince Russo. It was very reminiscent, right, of the Vince Russo emails that were accidentally sent instead of being sent to Mike Tenay, Mike Johnson of PW Insider.
Yes, and not speaker Mike Johnson, but wrestling
reporter no.
Mike Johnson as well. So, I mean, that would be our closest wrestling equivalent.
And really led to them, I think it was a major factor in them losing their deal with Spike, because they said no more Vince Russo, and here he is secretly doing this. Can't trust your partner very much if that's happening.
Do you, without like getting specific, have you ever found yourself like on the receiving end of something that you were not supposed to see, or some kind of a blunder, not of a national security level, but just anything in your reporting of someone maybe making a mistake in that regard with you?
I don't know that anybody's accidentally sent me things. I have inadvertently, I think, gotten access to some files that were not intended for me, I think, at some point. Not anything particularly sensitive and certainly not scandalous, but yeah, that something like that has happened.
Yeah. I will be careful. I'm not going to be specific about what this involved, but I was reporting on a story, and it was about, I was trying to find out if someone was working somewhere, reached out to that person. And what they did was they forwarded my email to other people in positions at this company and were like pretty much outlining everything, then replied to me, just basically not giving me any like kind of response or anything, just like a no comment or something like that. But in the reply, I saw all of this back and forth that essentially confirmed everything for me. And I don't think that person ever realized that. Inadvertently confirmed my story because
did they say that you were a highly discredited so-called journalist?
No, they had to. I remember it was quite a fun 48-hour period on that particular one. That's the best I can probably come up with for like a situation where I was just emails are tough for people sometimes operating emails and such. But anyway,
I did get a press release from one of the press individuals we interact with sometimes. I got a press release that was not intended for me recently. So that's
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah. So you. Sometimes it's tough to get press releases. Yes. We will go over this more with Sean, but the key names that were let go by TNA, Gail Kim, obviously the most publicly known figure who had been working within the Knockouts division in a pretty significant behind-the-scenes role, and she has had multiple stints with TNA going back to 2005, this being her latest run. Obviously a very popular figure, and you can see a lot of that that we'll get into more with Sean. Ariel Schneer, who had been... He had been involved in this company going back nearly two decades. He started there in 2006 and pretty much held every job imaginable. He rose up. He became the GM of the Fight Network. This was, he had become a senior vice president. He was overseeing. He was in a key kind of creative overseeing position with TNA as well.
The person that you worked under, or was that someone else?
I didn't work under Ariel, but I worked with him for many years while I was there at the Fight Network. If you're an astute viewer of Impact Wrestling, you may recognize him as Dr. Ariel, that made several appearances as the head physician on TNA. And I believe took a choke slam from PCO, if I'm not mistaken. Oh, he took a few bumps along the way, too. So, yes, he was also among the cuts. Rob Kligman, who was the chief revenue officer. So, again, like sizable like executive positions here being people being let go. Rob Kligman had previously served as WWE's VP of Global Digital and Integrated Sponsorship from 2014 until 2021. And Michael Shevchenko, who was working in their digital department, he had previously worked at Bell Media in Canada and with the CFL, the Canadian Football League. And in the email that Fightful has distributed that was sent internally, they also mention their goodbyes to Karen Clevett, Sebastian Destrange, who independent wrestling people may know a bit more as Sebastian Suave, who was running Smash Wrestling, Romy Glazer, who worked in the marketing department, and Raphael Morphy, who has had extended time working at he came over from the New York Mets, worked at the WWE for a long time in their live events department, then went to AEW for many years and had been working. I think he still works at the Barclay Center and was doing work here with TNA. I actually didn't even know Raphael Morphy was working with TNA as well, but he was listed here as well among the cuts. So this was an email sent out by TNA president Carlos Silva. And a pretty sizable facelift that they are giving the company with all of these changes.
And Carlos Silva has been the president of Anthem for just since December, correct? I was looking around. There's a press release in December. And it looks like he's establishing sort of his regime of people. And this is since Scott D'Amore has been out, right? They're sort of replacing a lot of the Scott D'Amore era people.
Yeah, I mean, this comes a year, well, just over a year since Scott D'Amore was let go. This also follows Josh Matthews, who was let go not too long ago. So it does have that feel of, a new regime that is being put in place. And on the creative front, Hunter Johnston, that will be overseeing things. He would probably be unavailable for comment, or we would need a translator. And yes. Tommy Dreamer filling in for some of Gail Kim's duties in talent relations. So that is the latest in TNA. I've got to say, for a company of TNA size, they certainly don't lack these major moves that garner attention when they do these big seismic moves every so often, every couple of months.
And according to Sean's reporting, there was another update today that this is an unpopular move with a lot of people inside TNA.
Yes, they also make a lot of unpopular moves, it seems, especially among the locker room. But we'll talk about that a little later on when Sean Rossap joins us at the bottom of the hour. Do you want to chat a little bit about this is not like a huge story as it pertains to TKO, but overall, Endeavor has now gone private. They have also gone through a name change. Get the Endeavor out. And now they are WME Group. And this resulted in some 9-figure payouts for Ari Emanuel and Mark Shapiro, along with new titles on the Endeavor side, as they are now controlled by Silver Lake, and their roles at TKO remain unchanged, but Endeavor / WME Group, now a private company.
Yeah, I mean, this doesn't, as far as TKO, as far as what wrestling fans would be concerned with, I can't see very many reasons why this would be a big change for WWE. As you said, Mark Shapiro will continue to be the president and COO of TKO. Ari Emanuel will continue to be the CEO of TKO. I'm sorry, it's president and CEO. Anyway, COO is Shapiro, CEO is Ari Emanuel. This doesn't change anything about the way that TKO is being run. They will continue to be owned by Endeavor. Endeavor owns 60%, maybe 61% of all the shares in TKO. Endeavor, well, what is it now? Endeavor, it's
WME Group.
Excuse me, WME Group will continue to be a company that exists, but it'll be private. It won't be on the stock market anymore. You won't be able to buy shares. TKO will still be on the stock market. You'll still be able to buy shares in it. It'll just be a company that's not on the stock market. And this is a company that went public in April 2021. Its stock has not performed that great. Some would say it's because there's no real KPIs with the talent agency. You don't have a lot of, you don't have attendance, you don't have TV ratings or something like that to look at like we do when we're looking at a company like WWE or UFC. and it's just harder to understand the value of would be, I suppose, Endeavor's version. But it has not performed that well relative to the index. So they decided to, let's just take it back private where it'll have more value.
Mark Shapiro's favorite analogy. There's a lot of wood to chop. Mm. They may be coming into some sizable site fees in the forthcoming years. The Orlando Business Journal reports that the Greater Orlando Sports Commission is looking for an $18 million grant that needs to be approved by Orange County. And they would be taking that $18 million to bid on multiple WWE and UFC events over the next 6 years, which would include a Survivor Series or Saturday night's main event in 2026, a UFC pay-per-view in 2027, the Royal Rumble in 2028 at Camping World Stadium, which you can see on the screen here, which hosted WrestleMania in 2017, and then leading up to 2031, where they would want to get a two-night WrestleMania at Camping World Stadium. So that is pending approval, but does give you an insight into the amount that they are looking at that they would value towards these, well, four events, but Royal Rumble and WrestleMania being two-night events. And then, of course, I mean, look at this year's WrestleMania, the amount of surrounding events beyond just WrestleMania. They are just flooding the zone of these weekends as well. But they estimate this would result in $120 million of economic impact.
For $18 million, yeah. I never know what to make of these economic impact studies. They're probably commissioned by people who are interested in seeing great results. But yeah, they're looking for all these big events. And we know that they were bidding on, or they were at least, they got permission to bid on a Royal Rumble in the last couple of years. I believe $850,000, something in that neighborhood for the 2024 Royal Rumble that ended up being in St. Pete, Tampa. So, that was, I think, more of a timing issue. There was some other event, I think, baseball All-Star Game or something like that. That was, does that make sense? Anyway, there's something else that was competing with the timing of that resulted in Orlando not working out. But there's clearly from the Orlando Sports Commission a lot of interest in WWE and apparently UFC events too.
Yeah, and I mean, we're getting to this point now where it just seems like especially for WrestleMania, that these are going to be divvied out, I think, years and years in advance with their deal that they have in Indianapolis. There is, I think, right, the reasonable expectation that Saudi Arabia is going to want a WrestleMania over the next several years as well. And then you have, like, look at this. They're kicking this all the way to 2031.
Right.
It gives you an idea of kind of where they are at in the rotation and lighting.
And UFC being part of this, this is sort of, you're seeing some of the merger effect that I can deal not just at WWE events, but I can deal UFC events too. And, oh, PBR as well. Maybe there'll be some PBR events in Orlando.
Yeah, how much of this $18 million would be earmarked for PBR?
probably not as much.
I want to know the economic impact study of PBR in Orlando. We'll continue to follow that, and I am sure Brandon has put Greater Orlando Sports Commission and Jason Siegel into his Google Alerts.
Yeah, as I recall, the Orlando Sports Commission is not a government entity, but if it is, I will be looking into that.
Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Let us continue on here with some other stories we have circulating around. We have... first of all, as the WWE is wrapping up its European tour, it will run the O2 Arena in London this Friday and Monday. And this is just days after the UFC ran a fight night card at the O2 Arena, just a fight night card. And this did its latest gate record for a fight night with over $4.7 million in ticket sales. They announced their attendance at 18,583, and my God, was there like, typically for these UFC shows, we see a lot more complaints now, I think, among the WWE audience at these escalating prices in tickets, but the European fans, I do not think they were happy with the amount here that it took to achieve this new fight night record. And there were like people like walking out of this main event on Saturday, but I don't think they care all that much, as long as these gate figures continue to be broken.
So 4.7 million divided by, let's assume that's a paid attendance. That's an average ticket price of $250, which is a WrestleMania level ticket price. Is that especially high for UFC, 250? And that's US. This is a US gate number that they're putting out, right?
Yes. I mean, that's not a ridiculous average price for a UFC show. I'm sure it's scaled a bit more. I mean, typically when we do see the odd time that we do see like a Polestar breakdown, the announced figure is typically like this.
I see that this was a fight night, though, as opposed to a pay-per-view. So this is a big deal for a fight night. Okay.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, that sets the stage of TKO reaping a ton out of the O2 Arena over these three events, as I imagine Friday and Monday very moderately priced as WWE stages SmackDown and Raw to conclude its European vacation.
And they did this on neighboring days, WWE and UFC, so they probably minimized some expense that way, too.
That as well. And I mean, they even got a seat for Drew McIntyre. I don't know if he plucked down $250 for his seat, but he did get a comp to go watch the fight night card.
It's not easy to get those comps these days.
We go back to this weekend. Let's go in order here. SmackDown on Friday night, they did 1,459,000 viewers and a 0.39 in the 18 to 49 demo. So the demo audience was down 25% from last week. This was up against March Madness, and they had multiple games that they were going up against. They finished fifth for the night in primetime on cable, but this would have been their lowest 18 to 49 audience of the year for the show taking place from Bologna, Italy. So yes, NCAA in full force here, and I think we could see some of the impact on SmackDown's audience on Friday night.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you consider the rank. Like, I'm used to scrolling down and seeing it ranking number one, maybe number two, but for it to rank number five is pretty unusual. But there's a good reason for that, and that's March Madness is upon us.
What do you anticipate? We are almost 3 months now into this 3 hour era of SmackDowns, and opinions aside of the 3 hour format, these have been great numbers for the USA Network. And do you anticipate that this is something that is like, if I'm USA, I would absolutely be pushing for the show to stay at 3 hours. But all expectation is that this will be reverting back to 2 hours, with the question of whether this is going to be a seasonal switch that they continue to do throughout the life of this contract.
I would imagine whatever they've agreed to is in writing. And I suppose if they want more content, they might have to alter their agreement and pay WWE more for that. But it's obviously it's what everybody knows. It's a larger demand to put on the viewer, and it's what you want creatively probably is to be booking a 2 hour show, not a 3 hour show.
Yeah. I mean, historically, if the money is there, I think the WWE will very much not concern themselves about burnout among their audience. I guess the question would be, is USA incentivized to pay above and beyond for that extra hour? Because there is nothing there going to place in that 10 to 11 Eastern hour that's going to come anywhere close to what a third hour of SmackDown is going to be. I will hope that WWE stays firm and just realizes, you know what, 2 hours is enough on a Friday night. But I think I'd be foolish to just assume that. Saturday night and Sunday, we got Collision Slam Dunk following the NCAA basketball tournament. And what were our results, Brandon? Was this a successful lead-in for AEW Collision on both nights for 60-minute editions of Collision?
This went pretty well. I think, you know, this is the first time we've ever seen anything like this where they've split the show up. I mean, you have all these. I've prepared a chart special just for today. We have, I think there's never been a show that has been so distorted by all of its preemptions, by going head to head with WWE. I've put like, I don't know.
This is amazing. This
20 different arrows on this chart. This what I call a shadow chart, where you're looking at, here's the current year versus the same year on the same timeline. Anyway, I mean, it's been either preempted a lot, or it's been challenged by WWE PLEs, or it's had these great lead-ins. There's probably never been a more contextual show. It's just so dependent on the context of whether it's tough competition, whether it's a really strong sports lead-in. But I thought this was a really smart idea. I tried to find out who's responsible for it, and I was told, oh, it was everybody's idea. And it's, you know, to split it up and distribute this.
Darby Allin came up with this.
Darby Allin might have participated, but to distribute the enormous lead-in value. And we do have quarter hours on the Patreon now for WrestleNomics. And you can see, of course, yes, the first quarter hour is huge, and then it's a huge slide down. Nonetheless, there's some value in that. Certainly, I mean, just speaking directly, you're getting more ad impressions being spent in the, certainly in those early ads that you run in Collision. So, and it's what this did again, to put it back. Well, I guess I have it right here. It did 584 and 554, which, as you can see, if people are watching in video, I mean, that's well above anything it's been doing in quite a while. Especially, I mean, you have to look to other examples where it had an enormous lead in from a college football game in this case, as opposed to March Madness games. So it's probably creating some direct value in terms of, okay, we get those ads in front of more eyeballs, and that just satisfies more ad impressions that we've promised to advertisers. So there's some real value there.
I think you can take a lot from this. And I think ultimately the test would be if you obviously taking out the lead in, you're not going to be able to maintain this level of audience, but does it give you the incentive to experiment a little with Collision? Like, does Collision, whether it's breaking it up overnights or experimenting more with Sunday nights, which has the caveat of, you would get Collision away from all this WWE competition. However, Sunday night's a really bad night during NFL season time. But I think it does
just
tell
you. Put Dynamite on back on TNT at like midnight after all the NBA games. Maybe just start doing that. I think that would be a little ridiculous. But I think there's, you know, maybe there are more opportunities. We have Andrew Zarian reporting that there's discussions about potentially doing something around the Stanley Cup, which WBD has the rights to is airing NHL games all season long. So, yeah, I would expect more of this in the future for sure.
And it does tell you like the value they see in AEW of trying to, I mean, when you bid on these big sports events, it's not just like that audience. It's how do we get these people and send them to other properties of ours? And Obviously they saw AEW as an audience that hopefully we can take a percentage of, and they'll sample this brand that we are isolating out of our whole programming slate.
And it's going to decline in viewership from quarter hour one onward really strongly, but it's probably going to hold viewership better than the, you know, the 18th run of Iron Man or whatever they're gonna put on otherwise after a big college basketball game or something like that. There's something else here, but I forget.
And the last thing here is the Netflix figures. This is for a week ago Monday for the March 17th edition of Raw. The show ranked globally fourth with 3.1 million viewers, and this was over the course an hour and 49 of runtime, falling behind Adolescence, The Residence Season 1, and Running Point Season 1, and also ranking in the top 10 among 23 countries. So I think, given this is the second week of the European shows, which are airing earlier than the typical 8 p.m. Eastern start time, it's giving way more access, I think, to a broader amount geographically that are likely watching this live. And you're just seeing that that difference in terms of the amount of countries that are showing up here.
Mm-hmm. It was up slightly from the prior week. It was the same as 2 weeks ago. Is this disappointing at all that this big John Cena promo didn't show more of an increase in this number?
I guess somewhat. It's I just don't know what is necessarily going to be that big boost, because honestly, I felt that Monday after Elimination Chamber was going to be the one that we would see a real big bump in terms
which was
of
the
like,
third.
Yes, that would have been the third. And I mean, it certainly was up. I was just looking at that one. Like, when you just look at the amount of attention that promo and the angle got at Elimination Chamber, like, that just crossed over to such a heavy degree, and we got, you know, an increase, but not through the roof, and it's sort of been there. But it's hard to discern, like, if, like, we talked about this last week, I mean, Raw's consistently in like pretty much the top five every single week. It sounds like in terms of the ad inventory it is selling, that has been very successful. So it's kind of hard to get a gauge on like where you look at this Raw to Netflix move in terms of like the value of what Netflix is spending versus what is coming back at what is typically the peak season of the year for WWE, and where this will be come 6 months from now when it's not the peak season.
Well, I believe so. Next week is the 31st. And then the week after that, the 7th, I believe we're going to get India will start to be included in this, which will further distort. But I guess we'll get that first episode difference to sort of measure, oh, it increased this much. We're going to maybe assume that that much is India. So oh, don't worry. Estimates will continue.
All right. We're going to take a break from numbers and charts and stats, and we are going to welcome in the man over at Fightful.com. Returning to the show, he is Sean Ross Sapp. Coming off a very busy day of news. How are you, Sean?
Hi, Sean.
I thought yesterday was going to be a quiet day outside of the Mariah May stuff. I was like, you know what? I'll drop this news. It'll be fine. And then the Mina Shirakawa domino fell, and then TNA firings. It was quite a day.
Listen, we could say a lot of things about TNA, but when it comes to cutting ties with figures that are going to cause a massive ripple effect within the industry and their locker rooms, they may be unmatched.
I got to be honest, man. Like, I've covered hundreds of releases, firings. I was legitimately more shocked that TNA fired Gail Kim than I was that Vince McMahon stepped down or was forced away just because of the circumstances surrounding him, obviously. Gail Kim is... I had posted on Twitter yesterday an automatic in to at least have a conversation with any women's talent in the world. Like, she maintains such a level of respect that is unmatched. Like, it was shocking to me. I could not believe it. I thought that somebody was just pulling one on me when they sent me the message.
And Sean, like, what is your understanding of what her position was, other than when she was appearing on screen as talent? Like, what was her role behind the scenes?
Talent relations and agenting matches. She was not involved in creative, although she would often push for creative within the company, is what I'm told. I was, because I asked about that, and somebody said, well, I mean, she would always push for things creatively, but she wasn't actively in creative as of the time she was gone.
And it sounds like, according to your reporting, that pushing too hard may have contributed to her not being kept on here as Carlos Silva is rearranging everything in TNA right now.
Yeah, and there were a lot of people that saw some departures en route. There were many that were surprised by Josh Matthews, because a few years ago, if you fire Josh Matthews, a house of cards falls, because it's like he knew how everything worked in the company. And they had slowly phased him out, among other people. Gail Kim was just one of those people that you have because of the level of respect she maintains, her experience, and again, her ability to draw free agents, her ability to make your show better from an experience standpoint. That was a particularly surprising element to me. But I haven't heard much negative about any of the people that have gone, like maybe little elements here and there. But by and large, a lot of these firings were puzzling to most people that were familiar with the work associated with these guys.
What's the sense you get, Sean, of the divide, if you sense one, of Anthem and the TNA side of kind of that institutional knowledge that a Gail Kim possesses? And if that is really understood, as you just mentioned, that Gail Kim is a conduit to a lot of key people in the industry, and just seeing the reaction to her release, if Anthem necessarily understood what it had in a Gail Kim, and if there's that kind of friction of like not non-wrestling people running a wrestling operation.
Well, I can tell you that Ariel at least made an effort to try to learn as much as he could about what it is he was involved with. Like, he was present at the NXT stuff when they would send TNA people over there. But immediately, Carlos Silva not being as familiar with wrestling, specifically some wrestling terms. I was told some like interesting phrases that he will use throughout. Like, I heard he called guardrails bike racks at one point. And people were like, it's just little things like that where people are like, is he joking or does he not know, type of thing. Like, they thought maybe he was participating in a bit of satire on himself. It was so unusual, because it's not exactly an uncommon phrase to call something a guardrail. But I feel there has to be some sort of disconnect for them, of all people, to let a Gail Kim go. You know what I mean? Because, like, it would – it's like the prom queen getting dumped by the kid that gets stuffed in lockers. You know what I mean? Because it's very clear she was working there, likely on a discount, probably had options elsewhere. Even though she had a tumultuous WWE exit, we know who those issues were largely associated with, and that was Vince McMahon, his view of women in general, not just from a wrestling perspective, but in general. And there is a huge divide or a huge just absence of female influence near the top of WWE, AEW in general. So, I mean, like, obviously she's going to get interest. I already had people from both companies asking me if there was a wait period on her or if there was a non-compete or anything like that. So I know that there were at least people of influence that were interested in bringing her in. That's one of the reasons also why so many people in TNA were shocked. They're
And there is no wait, you've reported, correct?
No wait. No wait at all. From what I understood, I don't know if they were asking her to do a non-compete or if they wanted like a non-disparagement or non-disclosure or whatever that might be, which have become a little more standard in wrestling these days when somebody gets out early, like a Rey Fénix or a Ricky Starks of the like. But
we're going to ask you to sign an NDA after the show. Okay.
Yes. Yes, indeed. She doesn't, what's a few months pay going to mean to her? This woman could have retired years ago, her and her husband, both. Like, she does this for the love of the game. So that's why also it was very surprising. I had one talent outright tell me they're not renewing their deal whenever it's up because Gail's leaving.
And that to me is, I think it's really just kind of indicative because, I mean, if you're someone that's been there for a couple of years now, like you, this is kind of just history repeating itself because with the Scott D'Amore fallout, you heard a lot of like talent, even like publicly, like that would state later, like Scott D'Amore was a major factor in me deciding to stay or not. And it's sometimes we hear that privately, but when people actually act it out, it's like, it's quite another. And it does tell you like the value that a lot of these talents place in some of these figures, like a Scott D'Amore and a Gail Kim. And it does add up over time when it comes to morale with a company. And just, it just feels like TNA gets a bit of that momentum going and then it's the pin popping the balloon and they have to kind of reset.
And it does seem like Anthem, specifically Carlos Silva, wants his own people in there. But it's just puzzling to me, man, because they're not AEW. They're not WWE. They're not on that level. And they are sort of a mom and pop level type of thing run by a corporation. But they're not going to improve, I don't think, by getting rid of the people that largely facilitated the growth. There were a lot of people. Mike Gilbert had a really nice post about some of the people as well, because I've been collecting information on these people. Sebastian Suave was a guy who was familiar with every asset of pro wrestling.
Yeah.
Like he has booked pro wrestling. He has promoted pro wrestling. He's been a wrestler. And a lot of people don't realize that. Romy Glazer, they brought into the company a year ago to help with marketing. And from what I understand, TNA Plus subscriptions doubled as a lot of part of that marketing effort. Like, these people got like brand deals that were not touching TNA before. Now, people like Joe Hendry blowing up is a really fortunate thing. But I'll see a lot of people online say, well, they're clearly about to sell to WWE. And I'm like, well, when was WWE last in asset acquisition mode? Like, and even the UFC under Endeavor, they didn't buy Strikeforce and WFA and Pride under Endeavor. They did that before. And since then, they've been, I mean, let's be real, the last few years, they've been coasting in that regard. WWE doesn't even license out their own libraries anymore. They're putting it all on YouTube, where they probably negotiated a higher cut with them to run those libraries and stuff. If you're WWE, what's the benefit of buying TNA? They'll let you use any of their talent whenever you want. Then you can sign them when they're free. I don't understand that.
I think you'd be attracting antitrust scrutiny, maybe not from the government in this term, but still civil lawsuits. And we saw that cost WWE $20 million in the case of the MLW lawsuit. And I think you're highly aware of that if you're TKO, considering what's happening with UFC.
I would argue that some of the reason that they did do this partnership was for the very reason you mentioned, to help
NWID, for that matter. Yeah.
And funny enough, earlier I heard you all mentioning about the email thread that John got included in. I'm pretty sure WWE found out that MLW was going to Tubi when I got like a press release, an early press release, while I was at a WWE event and was working on the story. And they're like, what the hell? We didn't know about this. What's going on here?
So it's your fault that WWE didn't make
might it. Might be. Maybe. But I think a little bit of it might have had to do with the Fox exec that called Stephanie McMahon and was bragging about it. And she's like, oh yeah, we'll see about that. But I mean, here's another one. Rafael Morphy was a person I heard was working with AEW or TNA last August. And TNA was like, no, absolutely not. Well, it's because he had a non-compete. He wasn't supposed to be working there. And then that he helped them get a lot of venues. I heard that maybe the performance of the UBS show is maybe a catalyst or excuse for his firing. But then people in the company were like, yeah, but look at El Paso and Dallas and San Antonio and all of these shows that did really well that he helped out with. So, I mean, there's a lot of people that surprised a lot of the staff and roster here. I didn't hear one person where someone went, yeah, I fully expected this person to get fired yet.
Yeah. Ariel Schneer is an interesting name because when I was at the Fight Network, I worked with him for about a decade. And like he came in like just literally doing like Raw recaps on the website and just continued to climb and climb and climb up until this SVP role. And of course, being involved heavily in creative over the last year. But if you were paying attention closely, he was seated in the front row at Elimination Chamber just a few weeks ago. So it tells you like the connection level two on the WWE front. But again, like here's someone that was there in the company for 19 years and is one of like the longest lasting employees up until yesterday with the company.
And rarely when you hear about three presidents in a calendar year, is it a good thing?
Sure.
Like it doesn't exactly scream vision and corporate synergy when you hear about three people within a calendar year and then all of these unpopular personnel moves at a place where you already have to sacrifice a little bit to be there. I mean, I can't tell you how many people got converted from salaried to exclusive paid per appearance in the last few years. I mean, then there were, you know,
you're talking about talent.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, talent specifically that were on salary deals and now are on exclusive paid per appearance, which doesn't make a lot of sense to me why many talent would do exclusive paid per appearance unless they had some sort of stipend or guarantee or anything related to that. But a lot of people got converted to those, or they wanted to, as PCO mentioned, they wanted to reduce dates associated with the deals. And they were bragging of their growth while cutting people. And that's common in the corporate world. I mean, we saw that within WWE. They would brag and boast about their record earnings while firing dozens of people every quarter.
As you take a step back, Sean, like, do you look at like what is the big picture move here? Is this sort of, well, this is going to be Carlos Silva's vision of what TNA can be? And in its marketplace, I mean, it's like they openly talk about like Access TV is just not the distribution level that we can do. But it just feels like TNA is in this spot, as you just mentioned. They're not WWE. They're not AEW. And I just don't know if there is that aspirational level of like that you can ascend to. Is this just a means to find profitability? Or at the end of the day, this is guaranteed programming that Anthem owns, and that's sort of its lot here, and keep costs at a level where it's not running too much of a deficit for us.
I've been trying to find out TNA's business model for years. I don't understand it. Like, I watch their show on Access, and then I see commercials for Sammy Hagar concerts on the network I'm watching. Like, I don't understand it. It has to be a loss leader at this stage. And if you look around, WWE got a better TV deal for LFG. Like, they're on A&E right now. I'm sure that
it's
TNA
probably
would...
the most watched show on Access, but yeah. How's it generating money other than, you know, ticket sales and merchandise? Yeah.
By all means. Yeah. And especially with, like, I mean, I can tell you, like, Moose is on a guarantee. He's on a very good guarantee like that, but I don't understand how the money coming in exceeds the money going out unless they use it as a loss leader. And I'm not as familiar with their Canadian strategy or anything like that, but it's just never quite made sense. And then I see some of the other things that end up getting TV deals, and I'm like, how have they not got anything? I mean, we were talking about like 10 years ago, Comet and Destination America and El Rey, these places were falling all over themselves to just try out wrestling. And now, like, nobody will touch TNA besides Access, even when they have NXT talent on their show. It's puzzling to me. I don't understand it.
And then I'm sure international distribution helps. Yes. They're in India, I believe. They're in UK. They're in Canada. So I'm sure that's helping them as well.
Yeah, it's got to. I mean, it's got to more than their Access deal.
We'll talk about WWE business in just a second. But with TNA, several shows in now for Maple Leaf Pro Wrestling, what do you see as kind of Scott D'Amore's strategy here and trying to find something for Maple Leaf Pro Wrestling? And do you think it can be viable being such a Canadian-centric promotion that, you know, has a lot of the DNA of TNA?
I think a lot of it has to do with what kind of schedule he wants to run it on, because, I mean, it was quite a bit of time between shows. And I mean, I definitely think it fills a void that's needed on the independent circuit for sure. And you can tell, like, he had the exact same production team crew from TNA. Like, you can clearly see that. Them and the West Side Gun promotion. You can tell if they all use the TNA production crew. But as far as, like, what he can do, I mean, if he remains at least some semblance of independent, he's going to have access to an awful lot of talent. Especially because if TNA is in bed with WWE, I would imagine AEW and other companies would be much more likely to be in bed with Scott D'Amore, who has helped operate pro wrestling at a high level, clearly can get buzz for an independent promotion. I don't know the landscape of Canadian TV or anything like that, but it's hard for me to believe that in the States, like, it will expand beyond a premium indie. I would love to be proved wrong on that, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's like AEW's on TSN, TNA got onto Sportsnet, and those are pretty much your outlets up here in Canada that you could be looking for. But I think it's a really tough way to go. But, like, it would certainly not surprise me if, you know, Scott D'Amore is reaching out to some of these people because he has history with them, and it does feel like he's trying to build an infrastructure. Let's just shift focus the last couple of minutes here. WrestleMania 41, we're just under a month away from the two-night event in Las Vegas. They are just bombarding Las Vegas with event after event. Will Sean Ross Sapp be going to the roast of WrestleMania?
I won't be going to Las Vegas at all.
Oh, you're not going.
I'm staying in Lexington, Kentucky. And
Brandon's on the fence. He might be our representative. Maybe.
The more that gets announced, the more relieved I am with my decision.
Amen.
Because I am getting far too old for that. I see a lot of people say, oh, well, they're running this. What about the indies and all that? And I'm like, okay, listen, I've worked a number of these indies. I'm very sympathetic towards these. But that is kind of like saying, hey, guys, don't plan your wedding rehearsal and your bachelor party the same week as your wedding because we got other stuff to do. It is their weekend. Like, they can run any of these things they want. If they see that Wally Mania is wildly successful as it is, of course they're going to do their own, probably significantly cornier version of that. That's just what they'll do. I mean, this thing is like now a 5-6 day situation, but they will certainly find out what works and what doesn't work this week, because they are throwing everything at the wall.
Now, which night of WrestleMania After Dark, which was just announced the other day,
looks
best?
Oh, my God. Four nights of it?
Jeez.
Valentino Khan is headlining Thursday. You have Metro Boomin headlining Friday. Like Machine Metro Gun Boomin. Kelly, someone I've actually heard of, is headlining Saturday. And Flo Rida plus Gronk for the big main event blow-off on Sunday.
You know, do you remember Georgia Line?
Yes, another favorite.
They should do, like, because they did a WWE thing, they should do Flo Rida, Georgia Line.
No, like, pit bull here, apparently.
Like,
we're saliva. We're saliva. I mean, these would be, the WWE hits all kind of.
I've been chasing a Josie Scott interview for a year. I came very close to getting it, but he just went on tour because they got a lot of wrestling centric songs. So that's like, I'm like, God, please let me get that before Van Vliet gets it. For the love of God, give me one. Give me one.
My goodness.
But I think saliva would probably draw a little bit better with this audience than some people. But, listen, I'm old, so I would most likely go to the Metro Boomin. Though I like his music, actually.
How would you assess this?
Oh, sorry.
You go ahead, Brandon.
What do you make of this? The Tony Hinchcliffe show, in that you've got a wrestling product that has tried to be pretty apolitical, especially in the era of Trump, and tried to have no politics.
Oh, until Chad Gable this past Monday, it seems they're diving in. Yeah. They're relaxing that stance. But yeah, they've been super apolitical, and you know that. I think there's going to be a lot of like just intrigue in this event of just that WWE is attaching themselves so closely to it.
So when I asked about the Gable thing, I was told that, and maybe it's them BSing, that they included it because they thought it was so ridiculous. They thought it was, you know, ridiculous that anybody would do that or even care about changing that. But we'll see. When I asked people about Tony Hinchcliffe, I got a lot of like eye rolls about it. They're like, of course, type of thing. But it's also one of those where most talent aren't being asked to show up or go there, just the people involved. So they're like, whatever. If it bombs, it bombs. But there's also a lot of those guys that know Tony and they do like him. But there were certainly some that were like, well, we're not down with what he said specifically about Puerto Rico, obviously. But there's a definite notice within the company that they're being a little bit more forward. And the thing I always mention is at TKO's heart, they are a talent agency. That's what they are. Their endeavor, and they want to get their bull riders and their comedians and their actors and musicians on platforms where people might not be familiar with them and then become familiar with them. So this is another effort to do that. I'm sure that he's either represented by them or they want to represent him. And that's probably a direction it's going.
Yeah, it's an interesting brand move. Because, I mean, regardless of whether it's successful or not, or it sells out, or it does terribly, this is, in a very small way, but maybe it's a signal of decisions that they're willing to make about what you're willing to say your brand is about. And UFC has gone the completely other direction, and they're doing really well.
Yeah, they might be doing the roast of Andrew Tate by the end of the year if it's a UFC's call.
Yeah, that was I didn't cover the UFC that night, or when I saw that they were there, I was like, you know what, we don't need to cover this show. I don't want to have anything to do with.
There's few things that stun me at these times at UFC. That one really
I was shocked.
I was the exact same, Sean. I was the exact
after Ron DeSantis of all people was like, he's not allowed here. Like, we don't like him here either. I was shocked that Dana White did that. I was very shocked. And I shouldn't be at this point, but I was.
Do follow all of the great work over at FightfulSelect.com. Sean Ross Sapp, who's a total pro, is going live in 7 minutes. What's coming up on the hump, Sean?
Whatever people want to hump about, you know, they send their humper chats, they send their super chats. Obviously, I'm going to rant about Gail Kim, perhaps a little biased from a professional perspective. I stole Gail Kim's finish as my first wrestling finisher. So I've got a lot to say about that. We're going to answer everybody's questions that they might have about this, give you some more details on these. And we are a largely viewer-driven show over there on The Hump, and I appreciate you guys having me.
Always great to chat with you, Sean. And
thanks, Sean.
All the best being at home over WrestleMania weekend.
I'm so excited.
I will as well.
So excited.
All right.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Sean.
See ya.
All right. We have a super chat here that we're going to get to. Jake from the Windy City sends us in. I like seeing WWE create a WCW YouTube channel with the classic Nitros and pay-per-views. Those don't need to be behind a paywall on a streamer at this point. I think you were one of the first, Brandon, to throw this idea out when we saw the shift over to Netflix and what was going to become of the non-WWE library. And we've seen that with the
you know, I made the bold prediction that Netflix was not going to distribute Mid-South Wrestling.
Well, I still think it's going to be a cold day in hell that we see the Smoky Mountain Wrestling YouTube channel that WWE creates. But for WCW, I would not be surprised if an ECW channel follows that. On YouTube, this is a great distribution method for libraries that are not going to have a whole lot of interest from Netflix.
Yeah, I think the era for paywall wrestling libraries was roughly 2014 to maybe the pandemic. There was a really good opportunity there, I think, to put your content behind a paywall and charge people $10 a month for it, whatever it is. And I think that we're now in a point where there's so much entertainment opportunity. There's so much out there that you can watch in any given moment. And people have those, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, whatever you want to say it was, to check all that stuff out and to watch all that wrestling that you missed or that you heard about, but you never saw before. And they had some years to explore that and pay their recurring fees to do that. And I think now the opportunities maybe more is better pursued through ad revenue in the form of YouTube.
It goes back to our discussion too about like to buy a TNA, like what are you buying? The tape library.
You're buying some IP, a video library, some contracts, some talent contracts.
Which you could wait those contracts out and just essentially cherry pick what talent you want.
Yeah,
and the video library, like you're not in that content acquisition mode anymore where these libraries mean a whole lot to you of versus what you are already sitting on of over 100,000 hours of content.
And I'm sure that there's a lot of great wrestling in TNA's history. Is Peacock, is Netflix going to pay you more because you've added that to your library in the next renewal?
No. If so, it wouldn't be just on TNA Plus, like if there was that grand appetite for it as well. So I think WWE is doing a very smart strategy with what they're doing. The WWE Vault channel, like that really does attack a audience that went wild on Saturday morning when a WCW house show from 1993 in London, England popped up and you got everyone to watch Sting in action. Another super chat here from Jumanji Hunter. There seems to be some current WWE creative pushback right now. How long do you think it would take for something like that to have an impact in terms of viewership? So we're not going to get Brandon's thoughts on WWE creative right now. That we got to save for a very, very special edition of Pollock and Thurston. But, you know, we've seen the inverse effect. And there was a time that I probably would have argued that creative means less than ever. However, that was during a period where we got some really awful WWE creative. And over the last 2 years, we have seen a giant opinion change towards WWE. And that has coincided with a huge business uptick as well. Could you see the inverse effect, Brandon, that goes the other way where, you know, poor creative is going to will there be that lag of business following creative that is not satisfying its audience?
Creative does matter to an extent. You all can decide whether this is the extent. I mean, the extent was over a multi-year period, the late Vince McMahon years. Yeah, it had an effect on attendance and on TV ratings exceeding the rate of cord cutting. And I think it did a lot to remove a lot of fans from their audience. What's the vibes that, our listener here is referring to? The WrestleMania build is weak.
I think that there has been, I think that overall, you know, this is just from my perspective, it seems that there are some, like the Cody Rhodes, John Cena match does feel like that is the main event of
too many three-way matches.
A lot of three-way matches. Like the undercard has had some very uninspiring storytelling thus far with a month out from the show. I think I think you're starting to see a bit of pushback towards this Cody Cena program in that you shot this incredible angle in Toronto that centered around Cena's turn, but with The Rock over top of it. And now Rock has been excommunicated from this. Like he is not even mentioned in any of this. And they could
snap to be at WrestleMania.
I would say if he is not, there will be a gigantic disappointment in that he was so central to this turn. And that has almost been omitted. It has been omitted from the story two promos in.
Yeah. Look, I
think, again, we are also looking at the biggest the greatest WrestleMania in terms of revenue that this company will has ever seen up until this point. And, you know, we can talk about these creative issues, but I don't think they are certainly not going to be paying any ill effects for the success of WrestleMania this year, no matter what they do over this next 3.5 week period.
I think ultimately it's a trust issue, and a significant portion of the fan base throughout the years of 2014-15 through 2021 learned, for good reason, that they couldn't trust a product that was led by Vince McMahon to be very creatively satisfying for them as viewers. If it gets a lot worse from here, of course it could get there. My sense is that we're a ways off from that.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for the super chats. We are live here every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern time, and the chats are always open. You can always send us your questions. Before we get out of here, I don't want to give away your findings here, but you did do some writing over the past week with graphs, which is always my favorite combination of Brandon Thurston, words plus graphs. What's the relationship between match time and match quality? Do you want to give us any kind of a indication of what spurred this on, first of all, to investigate match time versus match quality?
Well, this is a major scholarly issue that's been researched for years and years. I don't know. This is going to sound so ridiculous. This is a question that I've considered over the years and over my time of scraping Cage Match of its match rating. So what we've done here, and you can read the text that I wrote about it for subscribers. But what I did here was we collected all 43,000 matches on Cage Match that have ratings, and sort of took that as the y-axis, which is the vertical axis, and made the match time, the match duration, the x-axis, and I think they all have match times. And we see, my main takeaway here is that it tells you something about what's the burden of match quality related to time. And it is, I think, pretty intuitively, it tells you that the longer the match goes, you know, this is sort of the rating that I expect between a match being a good match and a bad match. I would say, let's say you watch a 40-minute match and, you know, it's a 6 out of 10, that would be pretty disappointing. But if you watch a 5-minute match and it's a 6 out of 10, that's fine. Probably. I think there's sort of that effect in what's being illustrated in the blue line here, that's sort of the bar that the audience, or at least this sample of voters, expects you to reach when you're going that amount of time.
Yeah, this is we start to see the slide here. 70-minute matches, not
that is weighted down by matches from earlier in the timeline, though. I did discover.
Okay, I understand.
So it is pretty flat. If you only say 2020 to forward, which there's a ton of matches in that period alone, it does get pretty flat. But then again, we are talking about a pretty small percentage of matches that are going beyond 30 minutes, 40 minutes.
For it to exist, I do wish that Bryan Danielson and Austin Aries did that 3-hour match instead of realizing, you know what, we're going to go home.
They're going to do a 3-hour match.
That was the plan that Danielson had, to do a 3-hour match. And then I guess it was whatever time period in the match they decided, you know what, this is
Didn't like Chris Hero wrestle for like multiple hours?
Chris Hero has done, some of those
like marathon, a gauntlet style.
Yes, he has. So maybe he would be the expert when it comes to a match time versus a match quality over a period of time as well. But always interesting research that Brandon is getting involved in. And you can go check that out at patreon.com/WrestleNomics. You can also subscribe on Substack to get all of Brandon Thurston's fine work that he is putting out on a routine basis, including your favorite quarter hours. Who's a draw? The ultimate question that keeps WrestleNomics going. Who is the draw? So subscribe on Substack and Patreon.
If you want some really big news here, we could break. I am working on reworking how we do the ratings reports, and we're going to leave the matplotlib era, and we are going to enter the data wrapper era, which everyone knows that means. So
you wait until 63 minutes into the show to drop that. Yeah. That should be the new headline on this particular show.
We're going to move towards different chart format, and when those charts are on the web, they will be interactive.
Okay. Well, I look forward to this. This is breaking news of the graph format. When can we expect this change to undergo?
No timelines yet. But like this chart that I'm showing you here, and I've used these in some different reports. These charts are data wrapper charts where you hover the mouse and you actually see a data point and stuff like that.
Can we get a T-shirt?
What's in my reports now? Yeah.
Can we get a T-shirt of this?
A T-shirt of what?
Of
that graph. Chart in particular?
That graph, that specific graph.
I guess you could. I'm not sure there's sufficient demand for that at this time, though.
Only one way to find out. All right. You can also go postwrestlingcafe.com. That is where Post Wrestling puts all of its extra work. Just put up a brand new edition of Book Club that Neil Flanagan and I do, where we sit down and we read a book. This one being The Queen of the Ring by Jeff Lean in 2009. Special Easter egg at the end of that particular show. And going up today, I wrote a lengthy piece on the life, the history, and the struggles of one Lex Luger, who will go into the Hall of Fame, including quite a look at how the WWE handled the death of Elizabeth Hewlett in 2003 with that infamous series of pieces that they put on Confidential when they were going on hard copy. And Lex Luger did not come off well in those particular segments. It's actually remarkable that there has been a reunion between both sides over the years. But Lex Luger will be part of the Hall of Fame induction class in just a couple of weeks, one of about 1,000 events WWE is hosting in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Maybe forget Sting and DDP. Maybe we're going to get Metro Boomin inducting Lex Luger into the Hall of Fame for some synergy.
You never know. Is AEW going to let Sting? Sting is presumably under some contract still with AEW.
He's under some kind of like whatever their equivalent of a Legends deal is. We can discuss this. It's quite the debate. My argument would he might get flack for it. I don't think I'd be too ready to give the green light on that one.
Yeah, so you're talking about Tony Khan.
Tony Khan, yes.
Presumably. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Or what do you get in return? Maybe there's some sort of trade.
Yeah, and I don't know what you would even...
I don't see WWE cooperating with giving him something. What would they give him for one thing? And I think they're pretty dismissive of AEW.
Well, I think the last kind of example of this was for, I think it was the Raw 30th anniversary, where they wanted Billy Gunn for some DX reunion. And the idea was, okay, he can do it, but you have to identify him as, he is here on behalf of AEW. They wouldn't go for it, like just to identify him as being from AEW. So, I mean, if that's the precedent, are they going to run a commercial for All in Texas when they're also running a Saturday Night's Main Event that night? No, they're not. And last year when Lex Luger was at the Sting retirement, it's like they couldn't show any of these WWE guys on camera. So, I mean, it would be a great moment for Sting to induct his friend. But I mean, Tony Khan is not cultivating friendships. He's running a company. And when the shoe is on the other foot, we have evidence that it wouldn't have been done. So I wouldn't expect it. But I mean, we will see. Tony Khan has lent a lot of AEW talent over the years to appear in WWE projects. So maybe he will give Sting the okay to do it. But we shall see. Wouldn't expect anything tangible in return. That would be my thought. On that note, we want to thank Sean Ross Sapp from Fightful.com for joining us. We will be back here next Wednesday to chat about all the latest goings on in the world of professional wrestling, site fees, statistics, charts, and then some. So thanks to everyone for joining us, and we'll see you next Wednesday. This month at PostWrestlingCafe.com, go XL and you get live editions of Rewind to Raw, Rewind to Dynamite, and Rewind to SmackDown, featuring all the news of the day, your questions and answers, as well as feedback. PostWrestlingCafe.com, $6 gets you in the door.